The Fable and the Flesh. There were eyes here well skilled in the observation and interpretation of all this, dark eyes lifted up to receive the whole of this manifold shining. They sought the causeway of the zodiac, the fixed ridge that ordered the billows of the sky, where the guardians of time kept watch, that sacred order of signs which had begun to appear in quick succession after the brief twilight of these latitudes. And first, the bull. For when these eyes were on earth, the sun stood at the beginning of spring in the sign of the ram, and thus with the sun that sign went down into the depths. They smiled, those knowing eyes, at the twins, as they declined at evening from the zenith. One glance to eastwards showed them the ear in the virgin's hand, but always, as though irresistibly drawn, they returned to the quarter of the sky where the moon showed her gleaming silver shield, and dazzled them by the pure, mild luster of her light. They were the eyes of a youth who sat by the margin of a well near the sacred tree. The watery depths were enclosed by a masonry wall, with a stone arch above. The youth's bare feet rested upon broken steps that led up to the mouth all round, and both feet and step were wet from the pouring of water. In a drier spot lay his upper garment, yellow with a wide rust-red border, and his neat's leather sandals, which were almost shoes, having flexible sides wherein to thrust feet and ankles. The lad had lowered his shirt of coarse bleached linen and tied the sleeves about his hips. The brown skin of his body glistened oily in the moonlight. The torso seemed rather full and heavy in proportion to the childish head, and the high, square shoulders looked Egyptian. He had washed in the very cold water from the well, showering himself again and again with the pail and dipper, a process which was both a pious duty and a much-enjoyed refreshment after the burdensome heat of the day. Then he had suppled his limbs with scented olive oil from a salve box of opaque, iridescent glass that stood beside him, but had not removed the light myrtle wreath from his hair, nor the amulet that hung round his neck from a bronzed lace, and contained a little packet, stitched with root fibers, of strong protective virtue. He seemed now to be performing his devotions, his face upturned to the moonlight which shone full upon it, his elbows upon his hips, but the forearms held out, palms extended. Thus he sat, weaving to and fro, and words, or sounds, came from his lips, half-spoken, half-sung. He wore a ring of blue faience on his left hand, and both finger and toenail showed traces of brick-red henna dye. Probably his vanity had led him to put it on, in order to dazzle the eyes of the women on the housetops, when last he had attended a feast in the town. But he needed no cosmetics, and might have confided only in his own pretty face which God had given him, whose childish oval was charming indeed, particularly the gentle look in the black, somewhat slanting eyes. Beautiful people are prone to heighten the gifts of nature, and to dress the part, probably in obedience to their pleasing role, and with a sense of performing service for gifts received. It is quite possible to interpret their conduct as an act of piety, and so justify it, whereas for the ugly to deck themselves out is folly of a sadder kind. But even beauty is never perfect, and by that very reason clings to vanity, and makes a self-imposed ideal of what she lacks. Another error, since her secret power lies in the very attractiveness of the incomplete. This youth by the well, saga and story have woven a halo of legendary loveliness about his head, at which, seeing him now in the flesh, we may have cause to wonder, even though the moon is on his side, and lends her soft enchantment to dazzle our judgment. Yes, what all, as the days multiplied, was not said and sung, in apocrypha and pseudepigrapha, in praise of his outward man, praise at which, seeing him, we might incline to smile. That his countenance shamed the splendor of the moon and sun is the least that was said. Literally, it was written that he was fain to wear a veil about his head and face, that the hearts of the people might not melt with the fire of earthly longing for his God-given beauty. And again, that those who saw him without the veil quote, deep sunk in blissful contemplation, end of quote, had no longer recognized the youth. Oriental legend does not hesitate to declare that half the available supply of beauty in the world fell to this one youth, and the rest of mankind divided the other half. A Persian poet of the highest authority goes further still. He draws a fantastic picture of a single gold piece of 6 half-ounces weight, in which all the beauty of the earth was melted down, 5 of which then, so the poet rapturously sings, fell to the paragon, the incomparable. A reputation like that, arrogant and immeasurable because it no longer reckons on being checked, has a bewildering and contagious effect. It is an actual hindrance to objective observation of the facts. There are many instances of the influence of such exaggeration by common consent, which then blinds the individual judgment and makes it willingly or even fanatically subservient to the prevailing view. Some 20 years before the time of which I now speak, a certain man, closely related, as you shall hear, to the youth by the well, bred sheep and sold them in the district of Haran in the land of Mesopotamia, said sheep having such a reputation that people would pay fantastic prices for them, although it was plain to any eye that they were not fairy sheep, but quite normal and natural ones, although of excellent breeding and quality. Such is the power of our human need to stand with the majority. But though we must not be influenced in this matter by reports which we find ourselves in a position to confront with reality, yet let us not err in the other direction with excess of tendency to carp, for the posthumous enthusiasm which threatens our judgment cannot have arisen out of nothing at all. It must have been rooted in reality. The tribute must have been paid in good part to the person when he was still alive. But to sympathize on aesthetic grounds, we must adjust ourselves to the dark Arabian taste then and there current, and certainly from that point of view, the youth must have been so beautiful and so well favored that at first glance he could really have been taken for a god. Let me then pay heed to my words, and without either weak compliance or hypercritical airs, venture the statement that the face of the youthful moon-worshipper by the well was lovely even in its defects. For instance, the nostrils of his rather short and very straight nose were really too thick, but the fact itself made them look dilated and imparted liveliness, passion, and a fleeting pride to the face and set off the friendly expression of the eyes. The curling lips suggested a proud sensuality, which I would not censure, since it might be deceptive, and moreover, in that time and place, would be accounted a virtue. But I am justified in finding the space between mouth and nose too full and arched, or I should be, rather, had it not been counterbalanced by a peculiarly charming contour of the corners of the mouth, from which, only by laying the lips together, without the least muscular tension, there ensued the serenest smile. The forehead, above the thick and well-drawn brows, was tranquil below. Above, it ran into bays beneath heavy black hair, which was confined by a light-colored leather thong, as well as by the myrtle wreath. The hair fell like a bag in the neck behind, leaving the ears free. And with the ears all would have been well, but that the lobes had been made rather long and fleshy by the silver rings worn since early childhood. Was the youth praying, then? Surely his pose was too easy for that. He should have been erect on his feet. The lifted hands and murmured sing-song seemed more like a self-absorbed game, a soft dialogue with the planet which he addressed. He rocked and prattled, "Abu, Hamu, Aout, Abaut, Abiram, Haam, Mi, Wa, Am." In this improvisation were mingled all sorts of remote allusions and associations. Babylonian pet names for the moon, as Abu, father, and Hamu, uncle. Abram, the name of his own supposed ancestor, but also as a variant and extension upon it, transmitted by venerable tradition, the legendary name of Hammurabi, the lawgiver. My uncle is sublime. Syllables whose meaning pursued the father thought through the realms of primitive Oriental religion, star worship, and family tradition, and made stammering efforts to express the new thing coming into being, so passionately cherished, debated, and fostered in the minds of his nearest kin. Ya-o. Out. About. He chanted. Yahoo. Yahoo. Ya-a-we-ilu. Ya-a-um-ilu. Rocking and swaying with hands uplifted, wagging his head and smiling up at the radiant moon. But other manifestations, strange and almost uncanny, began to creep into the posturings of the solitary figure. He seemed intoxicated by his own lyric ritual, whatever it was, wrapped into a growing unconsciousness that was not quite normal. He had not given much voice to his song, probably had not much to give, for it was still undeveloped, a sharp, half-childish organ, lacking fullness and resonance. But now he had lost it quite. It gave way with a gasp, and his Yahoo! Yahoo! Was a mere panting whisper that issued from lungs empty for want of an intake of breath. At the same moment, the body changed shape. The chest fell in. The abdominal muscle began a peculiar rotatory motion. Neck and shoulders stretched upwards and writhed. The hands shook. The muscles of the upper arm stood out like tendons, and in a flash, the black eyes turned inwards till only the whites glittered unwholesomely in the moonlight. I must remark here that no one could have anticipated from the youth's bearing a seizure of this kind. His attack, or whatever one might call it, would have surprised and perturbed an onlooker. It was so obviously out of tune with so attractive, not to say dandified, an exterior, and with a personality which immediately impressed everyone by its air of friendly and understanding courtesy. If his behavior was to be taken seriously, then the question was, who was responsible for the soul welfare of this young posturant, since it seemed, if not actually in danger, at least to be acting in obedience to a call? On the other hand, if it were but whim and child play, even then it remained questionable, and that it was something of the sort, at least seemed likely enough, judging from the subsequent behavior of the moonstruck youth. The father. From the homestead in the direction of the hill, his name was called. Joseph! Joseph! Twice or thrice, each time a little nearer at hand. At the third time, he heard the call, or at least showed that he had heard it, and there came an immediate change in his bearing, while he muttered, "Here I am." His eyes returned to normal. He let fall his arms, his head drooped, and a shamefaced smile played over his features. It was his father's voice that called, mild, a little plaintive, as always charged with feeling. Presently it came from close at hand, repeating, though he'd already seen his son by the well, "Joseph, where art thou?" His garments were long. Also, moonlight, for all its apparent and fantastic clarity, tends to deceive. Thus Jacob, or as he signed himself, Yaakov ben Yitzchak, looked majestically, almost superhumanly tall, as he stood there between the well and the oracle tree, closer to the latter, so that the leaf shadow patterned his mantle. His figure, consciously or unconsciously, looked even more impressive by reason of his posture, for he was leaning upon a long staff which he grasped so high that one arm was raised above his head, and the sleeve of his mantle or upper garment fell back from hand and forearm. The garment, a wool and cotton mixture in narrow pale-colored stripes, hung down in large folds. The hand above his head was that of an old man, and it had a copper band round the wrist. the twin brother of Esau, favored before him, was then 67 years old. His beard, though not heavy, was long and broad. It ran up into the hair on his temples, and fell from his cheeks and down upon his breast, at the same width, in sparse strands that were uncurled and unrestrained, and shimmered silver in the moonlight, with his thin lips showing through them. Deep furrows ran down into the beard from the nostrils of the sharp-ridged nose. His brow was half-covered by a hooded shawl of dark-colored Canaanite-woven cloth, which lay in folds on the chest and was tossed back over the shoulder. Beneath it, his eyes, little eyes, brown, bright, with pouches of soft skin beneath them, eyes grown weary with age, and only keen from the keenness of the soul within, peered anxiously after the boy at the well. The position of his arm drew up the mantle to expose an undergarment of dyed goat's wool hanging down to the tips of the cloth shoes. It hung in long, fringing folds, so unevenly as to look like several garments coming out one beneath the other. Thus the old man's dress was heavy and multifarious, an arbitrary combination of various styles, elements from the civilizations of the Orient mingling with those belonging rather to the desert world of the Bedouins and Ishmaelites. Quite sensibly, Joseph did not answer to the last call. The question was already answered, since Jacob saw his son. He contented himself with a smile that parted the full lips and showed the glistening teeth, set rather far apart, and white as teeth can only be in a dark face. He accompanied the smile with easy gestures of welcome. He put up his hands in the posture with which he had saluted the moon, nodded his head, and made a little smacking sound with his tongue, expressive of surprise and pleasure. Then he brought one hand to his forehead and let it glide downwards in a smooth and elegant motion. Next, laid both hands on his heart, closing his eyes and inclining his head. Lastly, he gestured outward several times toward the old man, with hands still laid one over the other, always returning them to the position over the heart, in token, as it were, that it awaited the father's coming. Again he pointed with both index fingers to his eyes, to his knees, head, and feet, falling back at intervals on the first position of greeting and worship with his arms and hands. It was a pretty game, played with all the rules prescribed by good breeding, but he brought to it a personal art and charm as well, the expression of a courteous and ingratiating nature, and no little real feeling besides. It was a pantomime, which the accompanying smile relieved of formality, of filial submission before the master and progenitor, the head of the tribe. But also it was enlivened by very genuine pleasure in the opportunity thus afforded of paying homage. Joseph well knew that his father had not always played the dignified and heroic role in life. His loftiness of speech and bearing had sometimes been badly served by the gentleness and timidity of his soul. He had known hours of depression, of retreat, of pallid fear, situations in which one who loved him would not gladly imagine him, though precisely they had been most transparently bearers of the blessing. So that if Joseph's smile was not quite free from flattery or from triumphant self-consciousness, yet it was in good part called up by pleasure at the sight of his father, by the waxing beauty of the moonlit night, and the advantageously regal posture of the old man as he leaned on his staff. In Joseph's childish satisfaction at the scene, there was involved much feeling for pure effect, without respect to any deeper cause.